And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Maria Kvillhaug about Norse mythology, her work on the seed of the Yggdrasil, and well, many other related topics, of course, that has everything to do with the Norse mythology, the cosmology, the initiation rituals, and everything else. And we were just kind of leaving off there, talking a little bit about the incentive or reasoning behind the beginnings of the raids. This is really, by the way, what Viking means as well, is to go on a on a quest, right? To go on a mission to not raid necessarily, but you know, a combination of things between there. But the official age, Maria, is like what, 793? The raid on Lindisfarne in England. The monastery is very much considered to be the initial step of what initiates the Viking Age. However, as we know, there are plenty of excursions by the very same people, the Norsemen, to the east. We have the Volga trade route, the Rus, right, the Kievan Rus. Even before that, we have many different tribes and people leaving the Scandinavian regions further down south. The Goths, the Burgundians, the Lombards, the Thervingi, the Gruthingi, the Gepids. They're just an immense amount of different peoples that have left Scandinavia, and the myths allegedly talk about overpopulation or too many people, so they have to, you know, find new territory and everything else. But what do you think was behind the reasoning of beginning this particular chapter in their history? Was it the onset of Christianity at the time? Was this perceived as a threat? Is there anything else behind it? What have you found?
Yes, there is definitely something to do with the Christian world, because probably many of you have seen Vikings, the series. I've seen it and I enjoyed it very much. But
it's pretty good, isn't it? I think they've done a pretty good job, actually.
Yeah, I like it. But they have some elements that are, you know, I would have done differently. And
sure.
Some, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The only thing that really sort of made me a little bit, oh, no, why did I do this? Because with the first one especially, they made a big point out of how the Scandinavians sort of didn't know anything about the world outside except for the east. So you have this Ragnar is sort of presented as a sort of Columbus who suddenly discovers the way that, oh, there is a country down there. And that's very, very silly, because the Scandinavians had they had contact with the rest of the world all the time. Ever since the Bronze Age, at least, there was constant activity, trade routes, because they were completely dependent on trade. And we find a lot of evidence for trade with, you know, as we find things from India, from China, in Norway, in these graves. People traded and they traveled a lot for a long, long time. And they had a lot of contact with the Roman world. And they reacted to it. I think that something happened in the year 9 in this famous battle of the Teutoburg Forest,
yeah,
where
German
tribes came together and actually managed to stop the Romans from invading further north. And that was very, very important to the Scandinavians then. They sort of became different from the rest of the world from that moment on. They were not a part of the general Roman world that, for example, influenced England very much. But later on, there were lots of movements in Scandinavia, lots of tribes that were on the move, or half the tribe left, as you already mentioned, a lot of tribes that left from various places in Scandinavia, moving south and trying to find, some of them even returned, actually.
Well, this is, I read about the Rugi the other day.
Yeah.
And this seems to be a very interesting etymological connection to that area in Norway called Rugi, and then you have a region the same further down south. It's kind of the same. You have an area in Poland called Gothiskanska, which is, of course, the Gothic Scandinavia.
Yes.
You know, so there's like, and then they seem to have returned back, and migration periods around that whole area is just fascinating of why that occurs. But just as you say, I think there was a tremendous more movements of people. They seem to have this idea that it was somehow isolated, and the people in these and this time was just kind of hanging out in their area on guard all the time, you know.
Yeah, they were not isolated at all, but they after they managed to defeat the Roman army, and they sort of maintain, I think they became very conscious about their that we are not going to be like them. They reacted very much to that kind of world, because they as I talked about before, that they were hierarchical and all that, that they had a ranking system, but they also had a very strong democracy. And yeah.
Ting, right?
Yes. They had, and it was more democratic than the one in Greece, actually.
Absolutely. That's so very funny about this. I'm glad you brought that up too. The stone circles, the judgment rings, where all free men and women, for that matter, could have a say in matters of what was to go down. It's actually very, very spearheading, and people forget this.
Yes. And this was also the case. What really spurred the Viking Age, I think, it was something that happened during the reign of Charlemagne, you know, the king, the
Holy Roman Emperor. Yeah.
Yeah, the Roman Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor. He was very, very aggressive towards heathen people, and he invaded Saxony. The Saxons lived, not the Saxons in England, but the Saxons in Europe, south of Jutland, which is in North Germany. This was a tribe that originally came from Jutland in Denmark. They had been forced to move down south, or to the, you know, to the west, to England, with the Anglos, because the Danes invaded their land in sometime during the 400s AD. So lots of people migrated west to England, where they later became Christians after some hundreds of years. While the Saxons in Germany, they managed to stay there. And the Saxons had a very strong democratic tradition. And they were pagans, and Charlemagne went into their land, and 30 years he spent crushing them completely. He destroyed all their sanctuaries, and he sent his way of paying his soldiers was to let them raid, actually, you know, go in and take what they wanted from the defeated Saxons. So they took their lands, they took their titles, they took the women, and they generally destroyed the entire culture and the entire land, and they put in a dictatorship with Charlemagne on the top.
Yeah.
And the Saxons, they fought back a long, long time, and they tried to go to Denmark to get Denmark to support them, but the Danish king, he took this very seriously, but he realized that he could not actually defeat he could not go in and intervene in Saxony. So what he did, a compromise by allowing Saxons to come as refugees, which meant that lots and lots of angry Saxons came to Denmark, where they met people who were heathens like themselves, and talked about what was happening. And the Danes took this threat very, very seriously. They were afraid that Charlemagne was going north after that. So they started to build a wall that was already partly there. It had begun a long time before, already with the first Christian missions. When the Christians took Frisia, it's just
Holland.
Yeah. Holland, yes. When they took that in the I don't remember the exact date, but I think it was 730 or 740 AD. Then they started to build this wall, and it was like the Chinese wall, you know, Danevirke. It was meant to make a border between the Christian south and the heathen north. And they worked on that. And during the age of Charlemagne, they intensified that work and also intensified all their defense strategies, they really, really worked hard to defend Denmark from Charlemagne during this time, these decades before the so-called Viking Age. And when they attacked the first time in 793, actually they had been there in 787, but that seems to have been more like a scouting trip or something where they checked things. But
yeah,
when they attacked finally, they attacked a monastery, and I'm thinking that what they did, they did sacrilege in that place, in the church and in the monastery. And what they did was actually almost the same, only less people were hurt, but they did almost the same as the the Christian soldiers under Charlemagne had done to especially one very important sacred site in Saxony, because what they had done was go into the place where this great pillar was raised, the Irminsul, and that it was during a ritual where people had left all their weapons outside of the sacred grove, of course. Which Charlemagne and his soldiers rode into the sanctuary and killed men, women, and children, and raped the women and put children onto. No, they stabbed them on spears and generally acted
like Christians do, like good Christians do, right?
I think of like, yeah, and they were much worse. And they also had this later when the Saxons were completely defeated. They had gathered 4,500 Saxon warriors, and they told them to be they would either die or be baptized.
Yeah.
And there were 4,500 soldiers, and they all fell down on their knees, which was a way of saying that we will die. They refused to be baptized. They would rather die. And what Charlemagne did then was that he forced baptized them, and then he beheaded them. So 4,500 men were beheaded and forced baptized before they were beheaded. And then the soldiers ran amok, of course, in the countryside where all these people were left without any warriors to protect them anymore. And wow. Remember that survivors would have gone to Denmark, obviously.
Yes.
I see this first trip as a vengeance mission.
Yeah.
The first time they sort of... I almost said a bad word.
It's okay. You're allowed to cuss on this program, so please go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to say. I really do think that this was a typical act of vengeance against a monastery, a Christian sanctuary.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It happened in 793, which was also, as one historian pointed out, what was his name? He has written something, Bjørn Myhre. It's he pointed out that these so-called Vikings, they were not ignorant barbarians. They knew exactly what kind of military and ideological pressure they were up against. And they had intelligence from England that the English kings were planning to go together, to join up with the French, with the Frankish people, in order to invade Denmark. So they had reason to believe that now we're not only going to be attacked by Charlemagne, but also by the English kings. And that was when I think they probably, it's probably a bit akin to terrorism, maybe, the Viking attacks. It was their way of scaring them off from trying to move further north. And it worked. They kept them away for 300-400 years.
Yeah, and of course, rightly so, because as we know, how many times have we not heard that in warfare? Obviously, as we know, the victors write the history, right? Those who even write at all the history in that regard. And when they do, of course, it's never mentioned what actually happened in terms of initiation of force. And the fact is that this is, of course, painting a completely different picture than what we've been told. But you've pieced it together by the available history that's there. So it's not really, per se, an omission. It's just that you have connected the dots, you know?
Exactly. And I have to say that I have not connected the dots. I've just, this is a part of history that I have not researched firsthand, but I've read several books by various historians. So this is not my theory. This is generally known among those people who actually study it. And I think that's why I was a bit upset, because I thought that these people who made this Viking, they put a lot of effort into it, and it's great that they did, but they should have been updated. But what I do think is that when people do research on things, that all the books I read about this are Scandinavian books written in Norwegian or Swedish, mm-hmm. Or Danish. And obviously, when this is being known here in Scandinavia, it will take some time before it's generally known in England, before their works have to be translated. There has to be an interest in having that sort of work. So it's not that strange, but I think that if you're going to make something about the, you know, it's not that hard to ask a Norwegian historian, for example.
Sure.
So that's the only thing that I felt that they did wrong, but also the way they represent the religion might not be what I would have done, but they have been quite good at cultural, many cultural aspects, of course.
Yeah.
They have.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've done a great job in many ways. It's just, you know, they could have just done a little more, tried to communicate a little more perhaps with Scandinavian researchers.
Exactly, of course. Yeah, I agree. So, wow, how very, very interesting. And please let me know if there's anything else you'd like to, you know, further onto that story of the various raids, and because it's not only to England, as we know, of course, there's many different areas. We have Rollo later in France, Paris, you know, yeah. So it's indicative of they're trying to kind of strike at the heart of the Frankish empire there, you know, in a way.
Yeah, I do have some other one theory of my own and another one which is not my own. The first one, which is not my theory, but which is generally known by historians, is that they also had their trade routes were blocked because they were completely dependent on trading with England, with France. They had done that for centuries already, and suddenly those people did not want to trade with heathens. So they blocked their trade routes, and that you know, that together with the religious and political threat, I think, are the most important aspects of it. But of course, during the Viking Age, maybe it began the Viking Age began, you know, sort of as a sort of defense strategy. But of course, it also proved quite lucrative, and they did develop a sort of pirate mentality, which you can see
and rarely. And rightly so, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the sagas, you have this, and then we went raiding, and then we went home to our wives, and it was very nice. they did develop a certain coldness about it, I think, but that was not that prominent in the beginning. But I think that to start with, it was certainly provoked, and probably they kept being provoked for a long time, you know. So, and well, I was going to add one more thing, because the Scandinavians before this, most of them were not actually Vikings. They were not pirates. This pirate mentality developed during the Viking Age, but before that, they actually despised Vikings. Vikings were exiles. They were bandits and pirates in the eyes of most Norsemen before the Viking Age began. And most of them lived to the east in Russia. And there is this very interesting passage in a book called The Primary Chronicles, which is a Slavic work, where they tell us that the Norsemen lived, the Rus, they lived a long time in Aldeigjuborg, which is south of the river. It's very close to modern-day St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
That was the first place where the Viking Rus settled. And that was before the Volga route. They hadn't discovered that yet. They were still on the Volkov route. And this is the time where I'm describing in my book. This is before they actually came. They had not explored as much as they had 200 years later when we start to hear about them.
I thought that was, maybe that I'm jumping ahead in the history, but I thought the Rurik, one of the empires, the Varangian chieftain, actually was part of settling one of these, Holmgård, right, near Novgorod, or whatever, yeah. However you pronounce it. Is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about an earlier period now?
No, both yes and no, because Rurik, he was born in 830.
So that's a little bit later, yeah, okay, I got you.
Later.
Yeah.
And he didn't come, something happened later when he was maybe around 850 or something. I don't remember the exact date either, but when he was a grown man, so I would, you know, no earlier than 850, he began to, well, he became sort of king over there, and he also was the one to establish Novgorod as a home god, as you said. But in the time I'm describing now, the beginning of the Viking Age, this did not exist. The Novgorod home god did not exist yet. It was only Aldeigjuborg, which was further to the north.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and they moved down the Volkov and into the Baltic lands and the Slavic lands a bit to the south, but they didn't had not yet moved so far as they did later and after Rurik. So this is before Rurik. And in the primary chronicles, we hear about Rurik, and we hear that the Rus lived in Aldeigjuborg, and they had made, they forced the other tribes to, there were Finnish tribes and Slavic tribes that they had forced to pay tribute to them. And then they rebelled against them and chased them out. And only later did they ask them to come back, according to the primary chronicles. And that was when Rurik came back, actually. Rurik was invited back, according to these chronicles, because those tribes kept warring between themselves, and they started to remember the time when the Rus were there and that they had peace.
That's funny. That's right. They invited them to kind of set, like, create some order in the region there, right?
I don't know if this story is exactly true, if this was actually the reason. I don't know if they were actually invited back. That could also be an example of the victors writing the history.
Right.
But they did come back. The point, what I mean, is that what is probably true in this story is that the Rus lived there for a while. They lived there since 750s, and then they lived there for many decades. And at some point, they were actually chased out. And what I am thinking, this is just my thought, but what happened? Where did they go? They were Vikings. They were true pirates, real, you know, slavers and everything. They were the ones who actually had built, you know, created those ships that could go, you know, that the Vikings were famous for ships that could easily move into rivers as well as move over open sea.
Mm-hmm.
It appears that the Rus were the first to develop those ships. So I'm starting to think that Denmark must have somehow received these people with their knowledge of how to attack by ship, you know, it's because they were actually they were thrown out of where they had lived and they had nowhere to go. And what would I do if I was a Viking captain with no place to go? I would probably seek out someone who would welcome me and
Sure. Perhaps
make use of me. And if I came to, say, Denmark and they say, hey, we are a bit worried about these people down south. What are we going to do? And they say, well, maybe we can help you. You know, that I don't know, but it's an interesting idea. It's because I wonder, what did they do? What did these Rus Vikings do during that period of time when they had no place to actually live?
What was the date on that again, you said? When were they thrown out?
Nobody knows exactly the date. This is sort of before Rurik. This was not so long before Rurik. I think it was just a few decades before he returned. So this could have been during the 820s, 830s. And that was when or 810s. I mean, so even if the Viking Age started out in 793, there were not so many attacks before after the 810s or something. From that time they started to really, really attack every year many times in Europe. And that would be very natural to think that this is also exactly the same time period when the Rus were actually thrown out of Russia. So
Rurik could have been part of their his old entourage there of people could have been part of also kind of giving tactics, let's say, to the rest of the Norsemen at that time, and this is kind of as a kind of a bad leader and one who teaches the knowledge of how to do this and perform this as a kind of an instigator, because I think some people have been trying to connect Rurik, the guy who actually set up the Kievan Rus dynasty there, with Rurik of Dorestad, right?
Okay.
The speculation that it's the same person.
That could be, but it could be. I mean, it doesn't have to be the same person, but I don't know that theory, so
okay.
I can't. But
right.
I do think that, we don't have to fix ourselves on Rurik, but
sure.
He was just one of those men who were called back to Russia because they said they want them, or maybe he just invaded. You know, we don't know that. But according to the history book, they were at the time they were invited back. But I really do wonder what they were doing from those decades where they were outside, and I can't help but see that in connection to the sudden intensification of Viking attacks during 8th, 10th, 20th, 30th. So
very good point. Yeah,
I don't know, but I would really like it if someone tried to figure that out, or you know, do some more research.
Definitely. Wow, yeah. Very interesting. Now, I don't mean to shift gears too much or change direction, but do you know if there has been a lot of old religious sites, Norse mythological, you know, so-called pagan sites, where there are stories of course, temples and things like that we just have not found any archaeological evidence of or you know, record, I guess, of yet. And I'm just wondering what happened during the Christianization period, that we've had a lot of things that we had up in Scandinavia destroyed, maybe even potentially by the Christianized people themselves, or the kings who initiated that step as a means of just trying to eradicate the old ways. What do you think about that?
Well, what I think about it is, I think it's a tragedy in many ways. I do not wish to criticize anybody's faith or religion, but I do have a hard time forgiving the fact that they not only suppressed the religion, but they even actively went about suppressing every memory of it, of that religion. They made up lies about it and called it evil. By sort of wiping out our history in that way, they have instigated a time of ignorance and superstition and religious persecution and a rather perverted view on women and sex that was not actually there before. So that's what I think about it. Obviously, historically, we have a lot of accounts of the Christianization, of course, seen from the point of view of the Christians. It was very, very brutal. It involved a lot of torture, a lot of threats, and a lot of killing. I won't go into the details. I think it's quite easy. You can just read Olaf the Holy saga and see what a holy, nice man he was. Holy as Charlemagne, something.
And isn't he isn't he the one in Norway that actually got, like, one of the first statues that was raised or something like that was of him, or in memory of him?
Yeah, he was a saint.
Yeah.
Well, it is a part, the Christianization is a part of something more than just religion, I think, because Norway at the time, now I'm Norwegian, so I don't mean to be, you know, chauvinistic about, but I know most about this. And before Olaf the Holy, we have Harald Hårfagre, and he was a heathen, but he was the first Norwegian. Before him, Norway consisted of 30 tribal lands. Many of them were kingdoms, and other were republics, like democracies. And Harald Hårfagre, he went on and united all of Norway. So he's been considered a sort of hero because he made our nation. He was the first Norwegian king of all Norway. But what he did was to suppress people very harshly. And he had, you know, learned from the south. He had learned from kings in other parts of the world. And he wanted to become like a proper king. He wanted people to kneel to him, and, you know,
And this was a new concept, by the way. It didn't exist in that.
As my grandfather Einar said, Iceland was actually populated because a lot of Norwegian people refused to kneel.
Exactly. Yeah.
They would rather leave, so they took their ships and their, you know, families and their animals and everything they could put on a ship, and they just traveled to Iceland and settled there and made a democratic republic there, because they couldn't stand the thought of living in a dictatorship, basically.
That's good on them. Good on them.
Iceland got populated. That's why Icelanders are so cool. But yeah, the rest of us were left here with one king. And these kings, well, the Christians, the church, they were very, very sly and cunning in this way, because they knew that if they could just get the king to convert, then the whole country would follow.
Yeah.
They would also have many arguments, because, for example, if you're going to be one king ruling all these tribes, then it sort of serves you better to have a religion that says that there is only one God and only one truth and only one, you know, in thing, only one center where that is going to rule everything. So it fit more with the idea of one sole king.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, but the first one was not actually a Christian. The first one to, and Harald Hårfagre also was the first to persecute sorcerers.
Interesting.
Yes. His own son, he didn't, he changed during his life. He was a heathen, but he also had a son called Ragnvald Rettilbeine. And Ragnvald was a great sideman, that is a sorcerer. And if you look at his nickname, Rettilbeine, it means that he had, it's very naughty. He had the opening legs. It means that he was gay, basically. But he was also a very great man who had lots of people under him, so he was sort of respected, which tells a lot about those people's sort of liberal view on things.
Well, I thought I've heard about the ergi, right? Was one of the highest kind of insults that you could impose on a man, was to basically say that they had unmanly behavior. There's even runestones that have been raised cursing those people, right?
Yeah, but also you have to realize that the Viking Age was a time of change.
Sure, yeah.
We have this old Norse culture, and then we have the Viking Age, which was a time where people were very much exposed to new attitudes towards everything.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously to be... If someone points an accusing finger at you, something in your culture, and says this is perverted, naughty, then it's very easy to be affected by that, especially if you're not that way yourself, and you look at this, and maybe you already had a sort of, I mean, they accepted accepted homosexuality after a certain fashion. It was not unlawful. We know that they made laws against people living together as man and wife if they were the same sex, for example. Right. Why did they make these Christian laws? Why did they make these new Christian laws if that had not happened before? You see my point? But
so it was more kind of in line with the more democratic values, that there wasn't a judgment made of however you as an individual wanted to live your life, correct?
Yeah, we don't know exactly how it worked, but we do know that suddenly we have laws against homosexuality and against homosexual living together. And they made these laws. Why did they make these laws? And why, again, they are new laws. So they have something has happened during that time. But I'm not saying that there was totally an acceptance of homosexuality. I think it was a little more like, if you compare with what you see in Sparta, ancient Sparta and ancient Athens, you see that there is a great deal of acceptance for certain forms of homosexuality, but not all forms. And I think it was for a warrior to be... the sort of the feminine part of a relationship, that was very, very, very shameful, actually.
Yeah, even, right.
But had something to do with manliness, not about actually the way you had sex, but or the way you loved, but about always being sort of the man. That was very important for a warrior. In that
well,
time.
Of course, exactly, and that kind of that makes sense, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Then I have to also realize that not all people were warriors. You have right. Slaves. You have some men who just are a bit lower down on the hierarchy, or you have sorcerers like Ragnvald Rettilbeine, Ragnvald with the open legs. And they had a sort of dispensation because they were not warriors. You see my point?
Right,
it's
yeah.
Different thing. So you have an acceptance, and then you have a not... So I think that the ergi, the unmanliness, the shamefulness of it is it was shameful for those men who were warriors to act like, well, this sounds very sexist, but that was how they thought in those days. They acted like women. That was very, very shameful.
Well, sure, of course. No, and again, that's my point. You can read that on some of the yeah. runestones around and everything else. And it was even, this is one of the incentives, one of the legal reasons that led to Holmgang, you know, or like when you actually challenged each other because your name had been discredited in public in that regard. And it was taken very, very seriously. And was one of the harshest offenses you could make on calling people certain things like that. So there you go.
I did hear about the graffiti. If I had thought about this before and I would have found the quote, I don't have it, but it was a graffiti from the Viking Age on one of those islands. I don't remember. One of those islands that they went to. Anyway, it was a recording of a sort of party that happened when a crew came to this place, and they spent the night in a cave, and someone wrote with runes on the wall, and that was not those they wrote a very joking poem about a woman who had been with the crew, who had a lot of fun that night, and then they wrote about two of the men who had not partaken in that fun but who had been more interested in each other. And this was written in a very humorous way. Ha, ha, ha.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. I think we shall keep a little bit of open mind and think that we have a lot of different attitudes in our time. Maybe they also had a lot of different attitudes in those times. And generally, they were quite relaxed about many things. It was just for a man to put himself in a position where he was not manly, if he was a warrior, was serious business. But I think they were quite open-minded in many other ways.
Well, exactly. And the point you're raising here is that it wasn't, whatever the view was from a centralized command, it wasn't institutionalized with laws and everything else in that regard, as it was later on when it was, again, it was a value judgment upon everyone else, how you should live your life. This is not allowed, this is allowed, etc. And that's indicative of the overall kind of tyrannical system, really, of the Christianization of the countries.
Yeah, they didn't have that at all.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was a lot more free to sort of decide for themselves, I think. But yeah. And they were obviously very concerned what other people thought. So it depended probably a lot, time, place, who you were with, you know, how acceptable that was, like it is today.
Yeah.
But I would like to point out some passages in the Edda. One passage where you have two men from warring sides, one from each side. And they are both sorcerers. So here again, we see that sorcerers were often associated with, well, they were obviously more free to be different if they wanted to, or if they were. And these two sorcerers, they come out before the battle starts, because that's how they did it. They have one army on each side of the field, and then they have two people who go out to offend each other before the battle. So they start to offend each other, and they start to accuse each other. They start to reveal that they have been lovers before, two men. And then what they start to argue about was which one of them was the man in the relationship.
The passive and the active one.
They argue about this before two whole armies. They have absolutely no shame whatsoever about them, about revealing that they have had a relationship before, a love relationship even. They are talking about love and romance, and you said you didn't want anybody but me. And but the argument, what they are really arguing about is who was the man.
Yeah,
because that was the point.
Exactly. Yeah. I got you. That's interesting.
Keep in mind about those things.
So this is that the Völuspá, the seeresses, and it was because I remember reading about that a while back, that that was associated with feminine traits, right? This was something that was exclusive to women to have this role, but then now and then there were men who kind of adopted this as well. And this could be interpreted in a number of different ways, of course. It could mean they just had the vision like certain women had, and or it actually meant in terms of sexual preferences, right?
Yeah. Transsexual or homosexual behavior is in the Norse texts very, very often related to sorcery.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Obviously, I think that was probably one arena where people who were not, you know, you know, mainstream could sort of be, not necessarily all gay, but that it was a lot of, you know, it was acceptable to be different if you were a sorcerer.
Exactly, yeah.
When people say that Side was the a woman's arena and that's why it was associated with shamefulness, I would object to that, I think, because...
Well, it doesn't mean that it's a negative connotation on the role as a woman. It was just the... that it was kind of reserved as a sacred thing for women to have this ability of seeing in, you know, seeing into the future and you know, prophesizing, basically.
Yeah, they had a different, what I was thinking about is that the female practitioners of Side, they were accepted in a way that male practitioners were not.
Right.
And there could be many reasons for that. I'm not going to go into all of them, but... What I wanted to point out here is that there is a lot of evidence that lots and lots of men did practice this. So we had lots of them, but they were persecuted, and they were persecuted several hundred years before. Female practitioners were not persecuted until after Christianity. And even then, there was a great deal of acceptance for women in Norway and Sweden who continued this art in a way after fashion. If they were discreet, they were actually not persecuted. They were not, they were suppressed in many other ways, but they were not actually burned on the pyre or anything like that. It took a long time before anyone actually started to point accusing fingers at female practitioners of Side, which was a sort of witchcraft, sorcery, divination thing. But the men who practiced this, they were persecuted, and that persecution started with Harald Hårfagre, who for some reason or other suddenly started to hate his son, you know, the one I talked about, mm-hmm. Ragnvald, open legs.
Right.
Suddenly Harald started to despise him, and we don't know exactly why he despises him, but I can imagine that it might have to do with Ragnar's sexual orientation, or with the fact that he was a sideman. But I think that why would a heathen be so provoked by someone who is a sorcerer? Why was he so angry suddenly with his son? He actually ended up killing him.
But it might be then indicative of the fact that he was beginning already then to adopt certain of the traits of the new incoming faith, right?
Basically, yes. Because here we see a change. Because first he loves his son. He gives him estates, and he lets him rule lots of people, despite the fact that he's what he is, or the way he is. So he's accepted and respected. And then suddenly his mother died. It's a famous story, actually. And then he suddenly started to... There is a story where that probably is not true, but which has probably been put in there as a way of Christian influence to sort of give an explanation for why he suddenly started to hate and persecute his son and other sorcerers. So, but it started with him for some reason, because he started to hate his son. I think his son maybe may have offended him in some way or other, but we don't know exactly why. But it could also be about attitudes about this, or if he's a king who wants to be accepted all over the world, and he realizes that, well, people are going to point the finger here and at my son. I don't know, mm-hmm. but speculate. But anyway, that's when the first persecution started. And then, of course, they intensified during Olaf the Holy, who, in all his holiness, made sure to murder, well, hundreds of sorcerers who were trying to fight against him.
So,
just going to conclude that male sorcerers doing Side were obviously common, and probably quite accepted, but at some early point in history, before Christian religion was introduced, were actually persecuted for some reason or other.
Now, let me see here, because we're approaching wrap up here. We do have a few minutes. We can talk a little bit more about some of the items here, but the problem, I guess, is here we have, I had so many more questions for you that we've never had time to get to yet. I mean, I had a long, huge list, and this has been very interesting. And I think it's a very, very, I love this discussion for the fact of some of the items that we've managed to touch upon and kind of examine. But there's a couple of more things maybe we could just kind of squeeze in there before we begin to wrap things up for this time. And just tell us a little bit more about an overall view of the mythology, if you can. I mean, I know that it's very intricate and everything else, but maybe we can just touch upon some of the main components of, you know, the Yggdrasil, the creation myth, and like some of the things that are, you know, composed in it. And maybe we could instead do a part two later at some point and actually get to some of the other questions that we had, that we intended for this show. But is there a way that you can wrap this up a little bit for us in terms of some of the creation myth stories, some of the components within it, do you think?
Okay, I'll try. I think that I think it's very, if you're quite new to Norse myths, I think that it's a very good thing to leave everything you may think you know aside. That's what I had to do eventually, to in order to be able to understand. You have to sort of look past all the stereotypes. I think that it's very important to remember that Norse myths are conveyed in poetry and riddles, and what appears to be fairy tales until they are studied more carefully. So, and when they are studied more carefully, it is very easy to see that Norse cosmology myths, for example, they're not fairy tales. They're built on a way of thinking that is very similar to natural philosophy, what used to be the closest thing that our ancestors came to science, because their genesis does not begin with Earth or with the creation of human and animal life. No, it begins right back with the Big Bang, when the universe was little more than a place of nothingness, surrounded by opposing elements such as heat versus cold, frozen mist versus poisonous gases. And out of these opposite elements, a world is created in the shape of a living being whose name simply means sound. And this sound is created by waves and streams. And then the gods appear as elements of consciousness within the primeval world of frost-covered rocks hurling around without any system to them. And our solar system comes into being when the sun goddess discovers her halls and she throws her right hand around those heavenly steeds. Life on Earth begins when the sun goddess shines her heating and life-giving rays onto the younger Earth goddess, like a nursing mother. And human beings are created after gods first walked the Earth and bestowed us gifts of mind and inspiration and passion to men and women alike. And they do that simply because they see their potential. And so this is a very short summary of how I understand the creation myths. And this, even if it's not scientifically accurate, it's, you can see that this is not just a funny story. This is actually deep. This is based on observation and serious thinking here. So, yeah.
Well, I would say it's very much actually based on something real, just the component of opposites, right? Of fire and ice, of the things that comes together to create the parameters of that narrow bandwidth of where life can arise. And even the idea of sound itself, I mean, that's something that actually a lot of scientists do. They are looking at harmonics and how waveforms actually create and hold together matter. You know, it's very cutting edge, I'll say, actually.
Yeah, I have written a lot about this in the Seed of Yggdrasil. I go through each and every creation myth story with the original text and with the translation and explanation of how, why this is like I just said. But was there more to your question?
Maybe you can just tell us what is the tree, the world tree, Yggdrasil? What is the meaning and function of that?
Okay, yeah. Yggdrasil is made up of two words, Ygg and Drasil. Drasil means, it could be used for a horse, but for a steed, something you drive or something you ride. And Ygg, it's one of the names of Odin. It means the old one or the terrible one, but it's Odin's name. So here we have Odin's steed, basically. And Odin is the best interpretation of Odin, I would say, is spirit. So here we have something, a vehicle for spirit. That's Yggdrasil, the world tree. And the tree in itself is a symbol of the universe, the physical universe that is ridden by the spirit. It has many other names, like the mead tree, for example, or the tree of memory. It basically represents the universe as a whole. cosmos, the physical aspect of it. And I would say that also the way that it is a tree, it should not be taken literally, because a tree is also, like Snorri tells us, you could describe men and women by mentioning male or female trees. They see trees as a sort of image of the human body as well. And the human body is also an image of the entire world. So we have many different ways of describing the universe. Basically, it's a metaphor. It's not an actual tree. It's a metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. And you have interplays with that, of course, of like concepts of the world axis and the idea that you have a kind of a shape to the order of things, like a tree as a function. And is there interplay, do you think, with the astrological observations into this as well, of concepts of the stars and the heavenly patterns? Is there anything like that?
I have found very little on stars, actually. I can't find it in these, very, very little. The only thing we know is that they knew that the sun was a star because they called her a star. She's called Vanarstjerna. That means the star of hope. And she's called the Dagstjerna, which means the star of day. So they knew that. And they had obviously also the description of the sun who comes and sort of claims her halls and put her arm around the steeds of heaven. That seems that they had a quite good grasp on the sun, at least. But the stars, no, they don't mention them that often. They just mentioned that the stars were there and that they found their places and in the universe. Astrology, I don't know. I have been onto it a few times, but I've never found something that is solid enough, really. I know that Venus is Friggjarstjerna, that's Frigg star. That's the only thing, I'm sure.
No worries. Yeah. No, I guess I also talked about it from the point of view that the idea that Valhalla is kind of in the heavens, right? It's like a concept of that. It's something which is above or beyond the earthly planes, right? And so there is kind of, it's analogous that this is something that maybe not is in the stars, but, you know, in a higher realm, I guess. Would that be correct, do you think? Or it's Valhalla, the location is a completely something different?
Location is probably not very important here, I think.
No, where is it in the sky? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. their concept of worlds, they have many worlds, not only Valhalla. Valhalla is actually just a place in Asgard.
Yeah.
The world of the gods, which is actually situated by the root of the world tree, not in the heavens. I don't know why people always depict it at the top of the tree.
Well, exactly. Actually, that's why I kind of brought it up, because it's a...
That this is Asgard, the world of the god, with Valhalla, is situated in the world of the Norns by the well of Urd, well of origin. So that's where it is, if you want a place.
You know what? We should, if you're up for it, I mean, we have so much more to discuss, of course, but we might need to have you back at some point again and just kind of pick this up and just kind of break down some of the pantheon overall, I guess, of the gods, the different, you know, levels, the nine worlds and everything else. There's just so much more to talk about here, but unfortunately we don't have that much more time for today, Maria. So I thought we could just end again with you giving out some of the details where people can pick up copies of your work, where they can find you online, read more, and everything else that you want to mention. Mention your two novels again that you have. One is out right now, and the other one is in the works, I guess.
Yeah, the first novel in the series is called The Hammer of Greatness. It's the first book in the Bladehonor series. That's a novel, historical fiction, about the life of the Osebergh priestess. It starts out in Russia, actually. So the other book is The Seed of Yggdrasil. That's a mastodont of a book with my interpretations of Edda poetry and similar, where I discuss many of the things I just discussed about cosmology, for example. There is The Maiden with the Mead, and there is my website, freya.theladyofthelabyrinth.com, my YouTube site, the Lady of the Labyrinth, and my pages on Facebook. You can find them links to that if you go into my website, actually. So.
All right, very good. Well, we'll have these linked up on our pages as well. So everyone who's listening and want to find Maria and connect on online and check out the website. And of course, if you're interested in reading more, pick up some of the copies of the books as well, the Seed of Yggdrasil, specifically if you want to know more about the actual, you know, the technicalities of the work, of course. Was there something else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, that these books are available on Amazon.com and .co.uk and some of the other Amazons, as well as some of them as ebooks as well. So,
all right, yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. This was a great conversation. And as I said, keep up the good work, and I hope we can have you back again soon.
Thank you. I would be delighted to come back.
That wraps up for this time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it and learned something new. We have much more to cover on this topic and, of course, all the other ones that we are following. Thank you for being a member and for your support. We couldn't do this without you guys, so thank you so much. We'll return on Friday with Daryl Hamamoto from the University of California, Davis, to talk about the book Servitors of the Empire, a very interesting perspective on New World Order theory and how the politically correct BS being pushed at the campuses around America play into the much larger agenda and a conspiracy of subjugation. Do not miss it. Have a great rest of your day or evening wherever you're at, and we'll speak to you in just a few. Also, of course, my thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John for all their hard work at Red Ice. Take care, and we'll see you soon.